come up on a tight wire.
I'm sitting here in Studio B across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sines.
And welcome to another edition of
Words on a Wire.
This week on our show, we have Tara Betts, author of Arc and Hue.
And on Poetic License, we have El Paso's own Gene Keller, who's going to talk a little bit about music and poetry and how it had such a profound impact on his life. So you want to definitely stay tuned for that one.
Absolutely. It's good to be back in Studio B.
Yes. We actually haven't been here for a couple of weeks. I've been in Madrid, but we record all of our shows ahead of time, so we didn't miss a week. But something interesting happened to me while I was there, and I wanted to tell you about that. I was there for 2 weeks, right? And it was great. I had a great time. I walked the city a lot. I did all kinds of stuff. I saw Goyas up close, you know, because I love Goyas so much. But on my way back, I was in the plane, and I have my smartphone, and I checked my email before you had to turn it off because I was going to be, you know, offline for about 9 hours. And I got an email from somebody. This email says, "Hey, Chacon, I hear you're going to be in Madrid." And because on that show that Sunday,
right,
I told about my trip to Madrid. He says, "I hear you're going to be in Madrid. I live in Madrid. Why don't you come? We can have a beer and I'll show you around." And you know, and I thought, wow. But I didn't get it until I was on the plane coming back to El Paso.
Oh.
But that's not the cool part. The cool part is somebody in Madrid is listening to our show.
I think that's really great.
Absolutely.
I think that's really, really great.
And that's the cool thing about doing a radio show hoy en día, you know, in these days, because people from all over the world can listen. If you have computer, if you had internet access, you can listen to our show.
And I think that is the beauty of social media. There's a downside to it and there's an upside to it.
Right.
It makes things very accessible to us.
Right, but you don't even need to be on social media to get our shows, because you can go to Podomatic, you can go to ktep.org, you can go to wordsonawireradioshow.blogspot.com, and there's so many web pages themselves. And we do have a Facebook page, and people can find us on Facebook, but you don't necessarily have to be connected to social media to find us.
Yeah, but I think that's how word gets around about our show, though, because I think all of the writers that are on our show puts it on their social media, and then that gives us a bigger audience.
Absolutely, and I post it every week on Facebook. Every show that we have, you can go on Facebook and find it there and listen.
And you're very faithful to that.
Yes, absolutely.
Johnny on the ball.
What I was wondering is who is the listener the furthest away from El Paso listening to us? Send us an email. Tell us how far away from El Paso you are. You can send it at danchacon@utep.edu.
Or bsines@utep.edu.
And let us know where you are, how far away from us you are. And we'll mention that on the show. It'll be interesting to see, because you know what I think? I think right now, listeners in Timbuktu are gathered around a computer listening to our words. Right now, at this moment.
To the shores of Tripoli.
All right. Join us. We'll be right back with poet Tara Betts and talking about her book of poems, Arc and Hue.
We'll be right back.
Welcome. Welcome.
Welcome to the Color Club.
Welcome.
Tara Betts is the author of Arc and Hue, published by Willow Books, the poetry imprint of Aquarius Press. She received her MFA from New England College and is a Cave Canem Fellow. Her work appears in Callaloo, Essence, Gathering Ground, and the Spoken Word Revolution, among other publications. She teaches creative writing at Rutgers University and lives in the New York City area. Arc and Hue is her debut collection. Welcome to Words on a Wire, Tara.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
If you could talk a little bit about the title and about the concept behind this book, or anything about the book that that our listeners might be interested in to make them go pick it up.
Well, as far as the title, Arc and Hue came out of just describing the drawings that I did on the ground with kind of my play nephew, Jabari, and just how quickly, you know, it's like it's very ephemeral to do those kinds of things, but it's kind of those moments that stay with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like as I started to lay out the poems, that's kind of what each of the poems felt like to me. And it's funny, there's a lot of people, too, when they say, well, I won't say a lot, but there's at least been a couple people when they saw the title, they were like, what would describe a woman of color? And they were like, the Ark and the Hue.
How old was the kid?
Oh, Jabari, he was maybe 5 when we did that, but
oh,
now he's like 13.
And were you awed by the genius of a 5-year-old as you were creating art with him?
I actually like talking to young people about art and writing and books because they don't bring a lot of jaded energy to it.
Right.
So that always makes it more engaging and more fun for me because that's the place that I create from, or at least I try to at some points in time. And then other times I really want to make a serious point, which is why there are certain poems in the book that are more political. There are certain poems that talk about social issues. And I don't think they contradict each other to be playful or to be political.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I remember I was in Miami. I was doing a reading at the university, Miami University, I think it was. And I was at a faculty party, and some of them brought their kids, and they gave them colored chalk. And there was this big sidewalk. And the kids were all drawing, and there was this one kid, and he was by himself the entire time. And this kid looked so intense. I mean, he would just step back, look at his drawing, and then come and then add like a stroke of blue, and then step back, and then add some red. And it was just this incredible, incredible focus. And I thought, man, kids are brilliant.
I want to ask you a question about the writing of this book and how you come to poetry and how you, in fact, put your politics and your passion and your aesthetics and your personal values and your literary values all together and how you kind of negotiate that. Is that difficult for you?
I don't think it's difficult. I think it's kind of a natural flow, which was one of the things I really loved about Ben's poem. What I can't remember the title. It's got Frantz Fanon and hummingbirds in it.
Oh, yeah. My father, Frantz Fanon and hummingbirds.
I read that poem and I was like, I love this because it shows how everything connects. It's not incongruous to be that way, right?
Right.
And I feel like I strive to do that in the poems. I strive to kind of do that in the overall body of the poems, that there's something that shows that all these things are happening at once in your head. And I think the best writers are really capable of doing that. Recently, I was writing a new poem. My professor, Maria Gillen, had challenged us to write a poem about being in the lingerie section at Victoria's Secret, which I'm like, that could go really horribly wrong in so many ways. But it's kind of like what you bring to it, right? It's like, if you're a woman who doesn't typically shop there, why? If you're a person who kind of looks at it as this commodification of sex, would you look at it that way? Would you look at it in a way where it's kind of raunchy? Or would you look at it in a way that is like, what does that say about our own sexuality? It kind of makes you flip and take the poem in a different direction. You know, and how can you play with the language so it's not predictable? So it's kind of exciting to think about how do we do that.
When you write a poem on your own, do you usually start with an image or with a voice or with an idea?
Sometimes it's one or all of the above. usually I see a picture in my head. Sometimes I overhear something someone says, and that sets me off, either in reaction to, or I see the thing that the person is describing in my head in a kind of off-kilter kind of way. But it just depends on the moment. Sometimes it's just a sound. If I hear a sound, it's like, how can I describe or capture that sound in words and make it visible or tangible to somebody who's not there to experience it?
And when you're working on a poem, is it just the poem itself? Or are you thinking of bigger projects and how it's going to fit into that? Or are you just in the moment?
When I wrote my first book, when I was working on Ark and Hue, I was not thinking of interconnecting poems, and I had basically looked at books by other poets. that kind of didn't do that either. When I look at Avan Jordan's Rise or Terrence Hayes' Muscular Music or Patricia Smith's Life According to Motown, all of those first books weren't necessarily thematic books. And I kind of liked it that they didn't do that. And now it seems like thematic books are like the order of the day for poets. But I don't know. It's funny. As I'm writing this new book, I feel like there is a thematic connect, but I'm feeling like there's going to be sweeps. Like, one is going to be like, there's this definite, there's a poet I really love named Susan Ludvigson, and she did this book called To Find the Gold. So, like, the first section of the book is all poems about the sculptor Claudette Colbert, and when that section begins to close, she starts talking about the overlap in their lives where it's poems that are about her, but it's like around the time Colbert dies or someone discovers her letters, I can't remember, that's around the time that the author is born, so she starts writing about that. So I think it may be more of like a thread that somehow subtly connects the different sections in the next book.
But do you find, or for instance, when you put the book together, did you discover that in fact there were connecting themes and ideas that you could then somehow order the poem so it would make a kind of narrative?
Sort of. I mean, I look at it now and I'm kind of like, the running theme seems to be relationships for me. And not just sexual relationships, because that's in the book too. But like, how do women relate to other women? How do people relate to each other in the Black community? How do we relate when you're in a community that people often look at as impoverished, when in many ways it's a very rich culture, or at least when I was a child, I didn't have, it's kind of like that poem Nikki Giovanni did called Nikki Rosa, and she talks about how she hopes that no one ever has cause to write about her because they don't understand that this community she came out of was very wealthy to her. It was wonderful for her, but they look at it and go, oh, how sad. How terrible, how poor they were, you know, and it's a different take.
How did you get into the poetry thing and the PhD thing and all of that?
I think as a child, I remember being like 11 or 12 and starting to write in a notebook and finding some kind of solace in that. And I was starting to read more as an aware person, kind of coming of age, and that made me want to write. Now, as far as stumbling into, you know, the open mic scene in Chicago and getting involved with Slam and then moving to New York City, I think I just said, whatever it is, I'm going to try it and I'm going to do it. And not, you know, I used to joke with Tyan Bajess a lot about, I ain't turning down nothing but my collar. You know, you just don't say no to anything. So at a certain point, it's like you kind of get immersed in the culture. But the PhD was something I had been thinking about doing for a while, and some circumstances opened up in my life, and I said, this is a good time to do it.
What are you getting a PhD in?
I'm getting my PhD in English and creative writing. So I'm probably going to do, and my fields of interest are kind of African-American literature, poetry, creative nonfiction. I'm dabbling a little bit in pedagogy. And for the first time in my life, I'm really thinking about critical writing in a different way.
Mm.
Like, there's been times I've read it. I'm not a big theory head, so it's kind of a challenge in a good way. And sometimes I see the need for why there needs to be more people pursuing the PhD, or at least thinking about how people write about us. Because I'm feeling like this is a conversation between people who do the writing and not the people who pick it apart and try to dissect it.
We're talking to Tara Betts, poet and author of Arc and Hue. Tara, you have this, you were talking about slam poetry earlier, that you participate somehow in the Chicago slam poetry scene. So I'm thinking of that poem you wrote called Neruda's Email to Slam Poets.
Yes.
And it's an imaginary email from Pablo Neruda to slam poets, and It starts off with from cantogeneral@gmail.com.
Yes.
And then it talks to slam poets. What in your imagination would Neruda say to slam poets today?
I feel like home still embodies much of that. When I was still in Chicago, I taught a class with teenagers at Young Chicago Authors that simply focused on Pablo Neruda's work and biography around his work. And it just further reinforced this idea that, you know, what Neruda did was act as a poet for the people. And that was one of the things I really pressed upon my students was, you know, you can write about French fries and you can write about socks and things like that, but you can also write about love. You can write about politics. You can write about the country that you love. Even if that country throws you into exile, what does that mean? They got to tackle writing about different issues and thinking about metaphor in ways that maybe people had not pushed them, and not just thinking about audience or, you know, just the fact that your audience will come to you if you really are feeling what you're writing about, because someone else feels it too. You know, when I think of Neruda, I think of him as kind of being the antithesis of why some people are in slam. Not to say that slam isn't really a beautiful thing for a lot of good reasons, but I want people to remember, why do you want to write? What are the good things about writing? What are the healthy things about writing? I don't think competition always brings that out in people.
I think that's absolutely true. I think competition brings out energy in people.
Yeah.
But I think that the written word, when done well and beautifully, it brings out something else in people. Mm-hmm. A different kind of energy. And that kind of energy is one of, I think, that more resembles meditation.
Who are your poetry influences, both dead and alive?
Well, definitely Neruda, June Jordan, Stanley Kunitz. Lately, I've really been enjoying William Stafford. Sonia Sanchez, definitely. Jane Cortez, I've been thinking about her a lot lately. She recently passed. I've been also kind of looking at what Maria Gillen is doing. She's an Italian-American poet. She's just bold. I really like her, because when you meet her, she's like a tiny little grandmother. You know, I just want to take care of her and hug her. But her poems are just like, they're so open and so honest, and each one tells a story, and she's one of those few poets that makes me feel like crying. And I think if a poet can compel you to do that, they're doing something powerful, and it doesn't have to be a surrealist sort of language, even though I like that sometimes too. I like Césaire. I like, it's the reason why I like Jane Cortez, or I like, occasionally I like Breton, or I like HD for that kind of spareness and strangeness.
HD to me is, for me, her poetry is hermetically sealed.
Yeah.
But do you read I?
Yeah, I love I. I mean, really, you can't talk about the persona poem unless you talk about I. I think she was just getting her due when she passed. But I know there's the collected poems that are getting ready to come out.
Do you read the poetry of Adrienne Rich?
Yes, I like Adrienne Rich a lot. I've always really loved her essays.
Oh, yeah, they're powerful.
Yeah. And Diving in the Wreck is the one you really got to read.
Oh, that's a great poem.
I mean, you got, that's like the classic. If you don't read that, what are you doing in the world?
We're talking to Tara Betts, author of Ark and Hugh, here on Words on a Wire. Tara, we always ask our poet, if we're interviewing a poet, to read our segment of Poem of the Week. So we're going to ask you to read a poem. And I think
I have a request.
And Daniel has a request.
Yeah, what would you like?
One of my favorite poems in this book, Ark and Hugh by Tara Betts, is called What It's Like to Be a Mixed Girl for Those of You Who Aren't.
Okay.
Did you read
that? I'd be happy to read it. Yeah. What It's Like to Be a Mixed Girl for Those of You Who Aren't. Well, I've got to say, it's people claiming you're torn between tragic paths when you know exactly where you walk. It's hair being pulled out by girls who see stuck-up high yellow stamped on your breast. It's brothers blurting, damn, I thought you was white, then asking for your phone number. It's being painted with zebra stripes and brushes that assume you're confused. It's classical and hip-hop cymbals clashing. It's you and your brothers calling each other nig honk because neither epithet fits. It's comparing yourself to chocolate vanilla swirl pudding pops so you don't carry the weight of in-between and enslaved fractions for names. It's your coworker's bottom lip dropping low when you hang Audre Lorde's picture above your desk. It's recognizing a bass-filled moan rolling into a phone's receiver from your mouth. It's questions, transitions, connections. It's tackling which hair moisturizer won't make greasy clumps or an itchy scalp with no help from mama. It's dreaming your hair curls in proportion to your miraculously darkened skin, then waking up when your voice reminds you you're black.
Thank you, Tara. That was lovely.
Thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Hello, my name is Gene Keller, El Paso poet, musician, and teacher. My most recent book of poems is entitled Tongue Tied to the Border. Back in early February, Ben and Danielle had a program on happiness and asked for any listeners who might like to respond on that topic. And I've been thinking about happiness a lot lately. When I was starting my book a year ago, I had an emotional breakdown. And I think the essay here reveals maybe too much information, as my wife Kathy Anderson says. But this is my response. It's called The Best Happy Pills. Lately, I am happier than I have ever been. As a child of seven traumas, I suppose I had good reason to be unhappy, as I was for many decades. That vulnerability may have been charming when I was young, but even I found it tedious eventually. However, I stubborned through 13 years of depression to, at the age of 29, come to the understanding that poetry and music were enough to live for. God had not been enough. Love had not been enough. Poetry and music saved my life. When I was behind my guitar or a page of poetry, I forgot the pain of victims. I didn't have to explain or defend, but simply be in that moment, the eternal moment the wise ones tell us is the true life. But even with music and poetry, I had to use a lot of psychoactive drugs to bathe the brain in enough serotonins to overcome the many wounds of existence. No pride, no shame. I survived. I learned how to cope. I found a good woman who accepted my flaws. I have children who love me despite my failures. 15 years ago, I had an accident that left me with serious spinal damage, pain that can drive me to my knees in tears, flat out on the floor in excruciation. Again, I had to turn to drugs, prescribed at this point. Each year, I have to take more. I wake up at 2 in the morning because my deteriorating body wants that drug. If I forget, within a couple of hours, the pain will remind me. The reality of drugs is they only mask the pain, and the mask is often thin. Unhappiness finds ways of slipping through. As a happy child who knew no better, I stabbed my big toe with a pitchfork. As a teen and into my 20s, I would push known sore points in relationships because I could. I did it to my brother and my first wife, an emotional browbeating with my barbed wit and mean words. In my 30s and 40s, the pain became anger, manifested in road rage, totally irrational in the particulars, based in the large cavern of denial. LSD had been my therapy, but those wounds could not be completely cauterized. In my 50s and 60s, the anger came home. How true the old song, "You always hurt the ones you love, the ones you never meant to hurt at all." In 1975, I saw a doctor who prescribed something that had no effect. I took the whole bottle, but nothing happened. That was my most serious suicide attempt. Glad now I failed, of course. So I stayed away from doctors. I was afraid their medicines would interfere with my creative process. But after 30 years of marriage, these outbursts, more common in recent years, were also becoming tedious. My second marriage was shaking apart. Last year, when I got caught being crazy at work, I knew the time had come. I am on some fairly heavy antidepressants, happy pills, today. My brain is continually bathed in serotonins. They work. It's not that I don't get irritated. I just don't need to say so. I don't need to be right. You go on thinking those happy little thoughts. I smile inwardly, in jest and reminder. What remains curious is that when I am playing music or writing poetry, the best happy pills of all, I forget my many pains. There was a brief moment during my most violent outbursts that poetry and music were no longer enough. I am glad their magic works again. Yes, I am happier than I've been in a long time. Yet something is wrong, or there would not be so many anxious, depressed, angry people in our midst. But I'm okay with that.
Maybe it's all this talk about war. There's a great depression at the core. Maybe it's the coming of another season, or I got a blues for no reason.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
And thank you, Tara Betts, for joining us. And thank you, Gene Keller. Funny thing, Gene Keller listened to the Happiness Show. Do you remember that show we did on happiness?
Yes,
where
I do
all
remember.
We did was just talk about how happy we were. Well, he listened to the show, and his poetic license is actually a response to the Happiness Show.
So thank you, Gene Keller.
Gene, you just made us happy.
And I'd like to thank my co-host, Daniel Chacon, and our producer, Norma Martinez, for making this show happen. This is Benjamin Alita Sines, thanking all of you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire. And remember,
the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a surprise.